Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Kai Wortmann, working in philosophy of education at the University of Tübingen, and I'm here today with Annemarie Moll, who is professor of anthropology of the body at the University of Amsterdam. We want to talk about her new book with the great and simple title, Eating in Theory. In this book, Annemarie asks how a closer look on eating can transform our ways of conceiving what it is to be a human. As we taste, chew, swallow, digest, and excrete, our food changes both ourselves and our environment. By drawing on extensive fieldwork at food conferences, research labs, healthcare facilities, restaurants, and her own kitchen table, the book offers possibilities to rethink central concepts in our philosophical tradition, such as being, doing, and knowing. The book is highly inspiring and very elegantly written, so I'm really happy to have the author here. Annemarie, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Before talking about the book, can you maybe start off by telling us what brought you into anthropology?
Yes. This is a long time ago. I was a student of medicine in 1976-1977. And I was studying medicine because I wanted to understand what a human being is. And given my secondary school background, I was easily convinced that then it was good to start at the natural science side and the biology science side. But as I was in medical school, I had the feeling that somehow I was learning a lot of facts, but I was not encouraged to think. So in my second year as a student, I also started to study philosophy. And because there I wanted to learn to think. And after a few years in medical school, I would have gone into training to becoming a doctor. And I thought it was too difficult to both be a doctor and think about it. So I shifted. There was some sort of escape program in medical school where one could make one's own master's program, design one's own education, so to speak. And I did that, and I wanted to, instead of studying medicine as in becoming a doctor, study medicine as in researching what was going on in healthcare. So I made for myself, I designed a sort of set of programs to read anthropology, sociology, history of medicine, while at the same time doing fieldwork in healthcare. So I became a sort of amateur anthropologist because I was supervised by medical doctors, by general professor of general practice, who was so generous as to allow me to do this completely. How to say this weird extracurricular curriculum. And at the same time, I also continued studying philosophy. So I came into this field in a slightly oblique way. And then afterwards, after I had my master's, I took real philosophy classes, so to speak, in sort of real anthropology classes and real sociology classes, but on a PhD level. I was really, taken over by no longer resting on the biology and natural science sides of things, but wanting to understand also that, wanting to understand medical knowledge and the way it came into being and functioned in socially. So that's the story. And at the same time, by the way, what I discovered was the then emerging social studies of science and technology. And that was sort of the field that allowed me to, where I learned a lot about how one might do that. And so my anthropology has never been an anthropology of faraway places, but an anthropology turning into Western modern societies. But in those societies, I started in healthcare settings, and I later widened out from that.
And can you remember the moment when it became clear to you that you need to write a book on eating?
Well, that's a lot later, because and there is not one moment. These things are gradual processes, certainly in my life. So I had written a thesis in the 80s on the way healthcare in the Netherlands had shifted its terms, and especially general practitioners and mental health care. Then I had written a book in the 90s on knowledge in the hospital and the way different technologies allowed for different ways of knowing and different ways of acting. And then I had written in the new century a book on how the process of medicine is not a linear matter of one choice after the other, but is a sort of iterative tinkering process of care. So, but in that later book, in that care book, so there were all kind of transitions between these projects. As I was writing the care book, I did field work with people with type 1 diabetes. And it struck me that the way that they talked about bodies and the way they lived bodies was metabolic, was all the time about a sort of negotiation about how much one eats, how much injection, how much insulin is needed for the amount of carbohydrates. And there was this constant negotiation between effort, exercise, and this was sort of a calculation from the outside that bodies without type 1 diabetes do from the inside. But it was a whole metabolic body that was practiced in those settings, or that is practiced, by the way, in those settings. And it struck me that what I read about bodies, both in philosophy and in social science literature, didn't attend very much to this metabolic way of living with one's body, and was rather invested in either perceiving or moving or both, and what in a medical way one would call a neuromuscular body. So it's about the neural system and the muscular system, but that there was a deep neglect, I thought, in both philosophy and the social sciences. And also actually history of medicine, of the metabolic way of living and understanding body. So that's when I thought, well, if I start studying eating, that might really be an interference and might allow me to make a shift in this way of understanding bodies that is so dominant in philosophy and the social sciences.
And am I right that this also connects to the title of your book, Eating in Theory, in contrast to, for example, a theory of eating?
Yes. So from the start, it was not my object to indeed theorize eating and to say, okay, we know, let's try to find out what eating is. But it was my object to say, well, if we know what eating is, what does that mean for the philosophical schemes or for the theoretical schemes that we use when we do all kind of other intellectual work? Indeed, eating in theory. I thought eating would good understandings of eating would really shift theoretical reflexes and theoretical repertoires.
And can you offer maybe one example to start with for one of these shifts that maybe struck you the most?
Well, I'm not going to make a hierarchy between my lovely chapters.
Okay, sorry.
But I can give one example. And let me give the example of the chapter on being. If you have a body that is, if you have an understanding of a body as seeing, hearing, and moving, it's quite an achievement of the body to see, hear, and move, for instance, through a room without bumping into tables. And it's also, you can understand a body. So you can try to theorize how bodies do that and what it means and how you have to be an integral body to be able to do that. But as soon as you talk about eating, it's not just one coherent integral body. You can see all kinds of differences. In eating, it's really very important that you swallow and that the food gets into the esophagus and the stomach rather than into the lungs. Because if you have food in the lungs, you get all kind of nasty diseases. You may get pneumonia, for instance, from the lungs not being able to cope with food. That's not what they're designed to cope with, or what they're designed, but what they're able to cope with. So the relation of the seeing and moving body through the world outside is very different than the way the eating body relates to the world outside. And this goes even further if you then go out of that room and you go and walk in the surroundings. And there's actually very interesting, good anthropological work on how bodies can move through their surroundings. But of course, if you think about eating, it is not my body that moves through the landscape and through the surroundings. All kind of surrounding things that first surrounded me, move through my body. I eat the apple, swallow it, partly digest it, and partly excrete it. And that's a very different relation to surroundings. And if we push that, and if we indeed take me, not me personally, but a high modern subject living in an urban setting, it's not simply surroundings as in a circle around me. Let's say if I walk for 5 kilometers, I have a land around me that I walk through. It's not very large land. But if I eat, my apple may come from France, it may come from New Zealand. And the coffee that I had this morning with my breakfast may come from Ethiopia or Vietnam. And bits and pieces of those lands enter my body, and then also when I excrete them, I'm attached to a sewage system that flushes out my excrements, my urine and feces out into the world, and who knows where that ends. So the being of the human in the surroundings is very different if you think through moving and seeing than if you think through eating. This eating is a more divided body, and it's a more spread out body, and it relates to the surroundings not by being in them, but by exchanging stuff with them, by transforming the matter. So in Dutch you have the word that stofwisselen. It's like the German word. It exists in German as well in a variation, which doesn't exist in English, but it's really transforming stuff, transforming matter. And that's what it is to be an eating body. And that, if we shift that to theory, so being becomes something different. It's not an entity in surroundings, but it's a constant transformation, incorporation, excorporation.
Yeah, and one of the, so there are of course several interesting aspects in this, but the first that struck me was that actually the question when the food is inside my body mm-hmm. is a very open debate. Mm-hmm. So for me as a person who never deeply thought about this, mm-hmm. it always was very clear that either if I take the food in my mouth and chew it, or if I swallow it, then it's inside me. Mm-hmm. But you point out how several people working with people who have swallowing problems have very different understandings of what counts as, I don't know if that's correct, but successful intake of food.
Yeah, well, let me say, interestingly, that is not a debate. It's not a debate in that there could be one of them winning. It's mm-hmm. really what is relevant about intake for this is especially in healthcare situations, what is relevant for a person in a particular situation changes when the food is inside, outside. Let me take one step back before answering that. I earlier said it was not my quest to know what eating is, but to shift theory from eating. At the same time, in as far as I'm trained as an anthropologist, I was not going to do, a cat and pipe type of example generating philosophy, but really studying at the same time seriously what eating is. And the only way to study properly what something like that is, as far as I'm concerned, is to stop knowing what it is, to block one's own knowledge and to really look what eating is in diverse practices without expecting a single answer, and really expecting that in different situations and different settings, eating is not the same, but eating is something different. Now, this really goes also for the question, when food is in the body. Indeed, you can say food is in the body when you close your mouth. And that is really relevant for instance, a person for whom it's difficult to put food in their mouth. If you have a person with dementia, they for them it can be really difficult to do that. It's not obvious, certainly not, to pick up a fork and to move the fork to the mouth. Also for some people with hemiplegia who no longer have motor control, that is difficult. So then there's the swallowing. And that, again, is really difficult for people who have neurological problems so that they cannot steer their muscles properly. I did a bit of research there with people with hemiplegia who have to learn to swallow again. So that's a second entrance. And then what also happens is once food is in the bowels or in the stomach and in the bowels, that doesn't mean that it will also be taken up in the bloodstream. In an embryological and anatomical reasoning, the whole pipe system, the esophagus, the stomach, and the bowels are still outside the body in that there is a clear skin and then a clear bowel lining between this pipe, so to speak, and what is called the internal milieu, le milieu intérieur in French, of the body. So the food has to get there, food has to pass the bowel lining. Now that's, in that sense, another outside-inside boundary from bowels to across the bowel lining being in the blood. But then, and that boundary, for instance, in when I did field work with people who are really very old and on the verge of dying, that it may happen that they can still swallow, but they can no longer absorb most of the foodstuff in their bowels. Now you could think, okay, food is inside the body once it's in the bloodstream, but that's not the case either. For people who have diabetes, have the problem that there can be, say, sugar in their bloodstream, but their cells are no longer able to use that sugar because the sugar cannot cross the cell wall. So there's another wall. It's the wall of the cell, and that's another outside-inside system because food is only in the cell if, in one way or another, it can cross the cell wall, and without that, there is no, it's not possible to use sugar to burn it and to use it to contract muscles and do other things. So yes, there are all these insights outside, but that's not a debate because nobody who is working on any of these situations will say that the others are wrong. The others have another concern.
Yeah. So for me, the reading all this was really striking. First, because of course it leads to the to realize that who I am and where I end, mm-hmm. or rather begin, mm-hmm. is not clear at all.
No.
And secondly, how to conceive this line or barrier or border is, as you just said, a matter of perspective. So,
no, I didn't say perspective.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. I can really understand that that's what you would think, so don't get me wrong. But it's not from how you look. It's from what you're doing. It's from the practice you're involved.
Okay, yeah.
And this is rather important to me. This is what I worked on earlier. This is the sort of the central concern of the book I wrote about knowledge in a medical system. The dominant idea in Western knowledge is indeed that there is one object and you can mm-hmm. look, you can stand around it, mm-hmm. and then everybody who stands around it has a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And you could say a painter sees it differently from somebody who is a baker or a cook and sees it differently from the teacher, etc. And they would all have a different perspective on the one object. Now, my storyline here is different, is to say, no, there is not one object everybody looks at differently. There are different practices in which an object emerges to be something different. So like I said before, in a trying to get food to your mouth practice, mm-hmm. the inside of the body is the mouth. Mm-hmm. In a trying to swallow practice, mm-hmm. the inside of the body is beyond having swallowed. In a trying to absorb food practice, so to speak, where in a practice where what matters is what is the body able to absorb across the bowel lining, the bowel lining is the boundary. So this is not one object, one boundary of the body that people have different perspectives on, but it's really different boundaries of the body that matter in different ways and that are relevant to different practices.
Yeah, and the term of perspective maybe too much emphasizes the perceiving subject again,
yes.
in opposition to a practice which involves all kind of things and doings. And okay, yeah, I can see.
Yeah, perspective is a visual metaphor, huh?
And
of course, for somebody who's trying to take things from the eating side, mm-hmm. I'm not bound to go with visual metaphors, but to really mm-hmm. think with practice orientations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that was interesting for me while you spoke, that you said that one you again get rid of the stuff you've eaten. Mm-hmm. You said something like, "Who knows where this goes?" But mm-hmm. actually, you do know because you did empirical research in wastewater treatment mm-hmm. Facilities, and this also was very interesting for me because it encouraged me to think, where am I really, mm-hmm. or where are parts of my body now in the world? Mm-hmm. Can you maybe expand a little bit on this?
Yes. So we just said it's not very clear where the body starts, mm-hmm. And it's in slightly different but similar ways. Not very clear where the body ends and when something is my body. So if you have a health problem and you're asked to give some urine because they want to diagnose you on stuff that is in your urine, you put your urine in a little bottle or a pot and your name goes on it. So then that particular urine is still you because it is carrying information about you and it's considered to be you. Your name will be on it. However, if you go to a toilet in a place where there is a sewage system, you flush the toilet, and you don't consider it the urine to be you. I mean, and the same goes for features. So, and well, people who have studied sewage systems more extensively have pointed out before that one of the disadvantages of this whole flush system that we have is that we also no longer feel responsible for it. We no longer feel connected to what we flush out. It becomes invisible and it goes under the ground. So, okay, we went, I did this not alone. I did this with a couple of my colleagues later on far more extensively. We went to wastewater treatment systems. And then, the different remnants of different bodies that are and are no longer those bodies are together there and get transformed. There are all kind of sieving systems, and then there are the bacteria that are in them are also used to downgrade the organic materials there. And yeah, then stuff keeps flushing out. One of the big problems in wastewater treatment at the moment is that it was made to dissolve to break down organic materials so that you don't have algae overflow in the water further downstream. But it has not been made to take out all kind of medication that is an added layer to all of this, medication that people have swallowed and that of which remnants of it, of those medication they excrete, and that too gets into our waterways and into our systems. So yeah, my being in that sense is extended way beyond me. So I do know up to the wastewater treatment system, but not beyond that, because what flows out of there, well, it's partly traceable. I mean, the bacteria that die in that whole system get burned, and then the ashes go into the building of roads. So my body is spread partly into the underlayer of the building of roads. That's indeed, as we are still talking about the chapter on being, that's really a dispersed type of being. I mean, the image of the isolated individual that liberalism has a fantasy about is really very easy to make that image falter and to make it if you wish to critique it, by thinking about this whole eating process and the transformation that generates an idea of a far more open, spread out, transformative body than the body within the skin.
So for me, all this was very striking, but I think maybe a few listeners now think, well, why should I care? Why should I care about where my parts of my body go after I flush down the toilet? What would you say apart from, was that already the answer you just gave? That it is possible to critique or change or transform dominant images of the individual and the self, or what would you respond to somebody who now listens and think, well, I thought about eating quite differently than where my body goes after I flush it down the toilet.
Oh, now you asked three questions. So
apologies for that.
No, that's okay. So why should you care? There are very many ways to why people might want to care. Let's say we cannot care about everything all the time. But
that's true.
There is a fairly direct material politics type of way to care, because what we flush out through our toilets then enters the collective ecosystem, the milieu around us. And in as far as it's not properly cleaned again, it poisons our surroundings, it's polluting. So there is this ecological concern with the polluting that is generated through everything we flush out. And that's not just our excrement, it's also indeed our medication, but also the stuff we use to clean. Now, that's not what this particular book talks about, but it is a first reason to care. The second reason to care is indeed the one you just mentioned, And that's what the book is more about. And that is that if we realize that our if we take the image of the self in this and what being is, if we take our cues here indeed from this spread out body, we have a far more collective, spread out, intersecting way of what it is to be a human than if we have a liberal illusions about selves beneath the skin. And this doesn't only go for the material stuff of eating and excreting itself, but really what it is to be in the world. So that's another reason to care. And then again, I'm not saying people should care. They might want to think with that, and it might inspire people for other concerns that they themselves were having with other topics. And I hope it would. My book is not of the kind you should care. But hey, look at this. What do you think? What might this mean for you?
This also connects to your way of doing research, which I found very interesting and also provoking and thought-provoking. Because the first chapter you call empirical philosophy. Mm-hmm. And to many people, this might sound indeed as a contrast in terms. But can you give an introduction? What do you mean by doing philosophy empirically?
Yes, I can try. This is a difficult chapter. Any people can also skip that if they don't want to read it. But you can read the being chapter, which is chapter two, without reading chapter one, but and the other way around. So the idea of empirical philosophy is to it goes in several steps. The crucial one is to say there is a tradition in philosophy that thought that thinking can be outside of the world. It can be above it. It can be transcendental would be the technical term. And I'm of the line among those philosophers who say, well, no, it can't. There is always thinking is always in all kind of ways part of the rest of the world. It's an element. It's always imminent, so to speak. And there are all kind of links between philosophical words, terms, concepts, and the world that they emerge from and the worlds that they enter. And let me explain it through one of the explanations I use in the chapter, the exemplary situation. I really like that one. And it was the way I use the word in the book, I take from Lola Nauta, who was my PhD supervisor in the 80s. And what he said is that if you read philosophers, even if they think they're transcendental, they actually always, it becomes far more easy to read them if you realize the specific empirical situation that they happen to be reflecting upon. So empirical philosophy in my books doesn't mean taking reality seriously and being bound by it, but it means read into text what they are inspired by. One of the easy examples that Nauta used was if you read Sartre on the stranger, that may seem very abstract, but if you realize that the man was sitting in a cafe in Paris watching people walking by, suddenly his theories about the strangers make a lot more sense. So that would be what Nauta called the exemplary situation that is embedded in the philosophy, whether the philosopher says so or not. I mean, the other famous example is that of many more historians have written about this, about John Locke, who was writing about what it is to own, about possession. And in the exemplary situation there is that he was an English gentleman owning land in what later became the United States of America. So could one own land? And there were all kinds of theories in Locke about how land can only be owned if you work it in a specific agricultural way. Now, that was to disqualify Native Americans who were living with the land in very different ways, and to say, no, they cannot own it. neither would they want to. But this whole idea of ownership is based on that empirical exemplary situation. Okay. Now, once you recognize in all kind of other philosophers that their texts have exemplary situations hidden within them, you can start to say, but then if we make new philosophy, we can make a bit more work of the exemplary situation that we want to think about and think with. So rather than trying to escape exemplary situations, we can play with them and work with them. And one of my sources of inspiration there is the work of Michel Serres, who has done a lot of that. He has been using all kind of images and realities that he chews on and works with in his various books, and shifting around new empirical stories allows him to say new things. But he didn't work on eating, so I did that bit. Does that make sense? Is that clear enough, I mean?
Yeah.
So you could say it's a sort of heuristic. It's a way of getting inspiration. It's so, and to fall back to what we talked about earlier, in those empirical philosophy terms or exemplary situation terms, I say, well, all kind of ways in we think about being have as their implied or their implicit empirical referent a neuromuscular mm-hmm. body. So mm-hmm. if I explicitly attend to an eating body, what can I shift around? What kind of new terms and new ways of understanding terms emerge from that exercise? So it's a sort of, it's in a way a serious game.
So for the people who did not read it, throughout the book you present a short, polished versions of field notes, could I say this? Mm-hmm. So observations and descriptions of practices and situations you experienced. So would you say that these are your attempts of, so to speak, making the exemplary situations explicit?
Yes, and also of generating new exemplary situations.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
generating, I mean.
So these are not just situations I passively experienced. They are situations mm-hmm. I went to search. I went mm-hmm. out of my way to go and generate them, to turn them from an event into an exemplary situation, into something to chew on mm-hmm. and to learn from. And they're quite diverse. So that's also what eating is, does not emerge as one coherent thing from this book. Eating, just as we already talked about how the body boundaries are different in relation to different eating concerns, eating is also something very different depending on practices where it matters or where you go and look for it. So yes, mm-hmm. I did ethnographic fieldwork in highly diverse situation. And by the way, I had a great grant for this whole project. So there were really wonderful, good junior people working with me who also did research into eating for their own concerns and their own questions. So, and we had an ongoing conversation about all this research. So I took inspiration from their research as well, and learned a lot from them about what eating can be in all kind of empirical settings. Plus, of course, we read lots of books of yet other authors who study eating in other settings. So this multiplicity of versions of eating was a way to get really diverse and rich inspiration to shift the ways of thinking around.
Okay, so we talked about the first chapters extensively, and I'm afraid we will not have time to touch upon the following chapters in such a detail. But I would like to offer you the maybe to choose one more chapters on knowing, doing, relating to further go into them.
Okay. Well, let me do knowing. Then we keep the rest of the book in suspense. People might actually want to read it. So with knowing, one of the things that I think, to be a bit short about that chapter, that's really interesting about knowing and taking eating as a case for that, traditional images of traditional understandings, let me put it like that, of knowing, were such that it was that there was a sharp division between perception and sensation, and perception was from the outside world and sensation was from the body. And then the idea was perception could really be done through seeing and hearing, while those were called the distal senses, while smelling and tasting were the proximal senses and were not really very informative about the world. And touch would then be a sort of an intermediate between them. Now, I was reading upon this, and you can imagine, as somebody who was studying eating, I was particularly interested in smelling and tasting. And I was reading various people who were saying how that too could be a way of knowing the outside world. And then it struck to me that then often cases they were presenting were cases where people were using smelling and eating indeed to smelling and tasting to perceive, but then they would spit out to keep their senses pure. Let's say if you do wine tasting, one tends to spit out the wine so as to not to still be able to taste the next sip of wine of the next glass. And what is interesting is that, of course, if one swallows and doesn't just taste but really swallows, the eating transforms the body. And that with the wine, this is very clear. If you have three glasses of wine, you really are not going to be subtle enough to taste the fourth one. But it's also the case with meals. If I'm very hungry at the beginning of a meal, after I've had a plateful of food, I'm not so keen to have soup again, or I might just have a bit of dessert and maybe not even that. I'm no longer hungry. So the taste of what one tastes really changes through eating. And that then again also gives a different image of what knowing could be. It's a type of knowing where the subject does not stay the same, but is transformed by the object that it knows. And the object does not stay the same either. If I eat an apple, you cannot no longer know it because I have changed it. It is no longer visible. It is still, it's active in my body to make me perky and allow me to go for my walk. So both what the eating provides is an image where knowing is not distal, is not staying at a distance from the object of knowing, but where knowing is transforming the object and being transformed by it. So that's a rather different way of imagining knowledge than the classical one, where you could say that the exemplary situation in the classical one is staring at a painting, and you're not supposed to take out your own color, coloring stuff and change the painting, but you're staring at the painting with your hands on your back, while the image of knowing in relation to eating is, eating, so to speak, allows us to articulate a mode of knowing where everything transforms in the process of knowing and transforming. They are no longer, it's no longer possible to disentangle them.
And would you say these two images of knowing can be in conversation with each other, or can, would you say it is possible to transfer the knowing image from eating to the situation of watching a picture?
Well, I would rather say what this particular book does is addition. So I add further understandings of being, knowing, doing, and relating. And I'm not critiquing. I'm not saying what has been done so far is all wrong, and now come me, and I'm really knowing how it is, how it really is. So, I mean, this this dispute model of doing theory I really dislike. I think it's what I'm trying to do here is rather add new models so that others who read these things can think through in the situations they want to understand or the situations they grapple with, what might be a good way of handling that, what might serve them, what might, or what the effect of different ways of understanding might be. So some situations may call for the staring mode of knowing, and other situations you may think, but wait a minute, what if we think about this in a transformative mode of knowing? So in that sense, I think the theoretical repertoires are rather like tools. And if in some cases, I mean, this is Foucauldian thought, but if in some cases you want to hammer, in other cases you want to sew, in other cases you want to paint. And I don't think we need a kind of theoretical imagination where there is only one and one big truth. That's a very sad mono idea. And rather than having such a mono philosophy, I think it's far more interesting to have rich repertoires and lots of them, that and the ability to move between them and to play with them.
But do we need one? I mean, that's an open question. Do we need one that tells us how hammering and sewing hangs together, or rather when to hammer or when to sew?
Do you need that?
I don't know. It's a question I wrestle with a lot.
I don't particularly like philosophical theories that are affirmative and tell me what to do, and I don't want to write theory that tells other people what to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that kind of normative repertoire, where the normative takes on the shape of this is how it should be done, mm-hmm. I don't think that's very helpful, because situations are always more specific, and it's far more how to say that. I like the inspiration over the rule, and a sort of versatility over standards. When it comes to theorizing, and when it comes to doing writing books or thinking about the world, because that kind of false handholds. Well, I already say false handholds. Handholds tend to be false because you always have to look at the specificity of a situation, and it's always richer than what somebody from a distance could tell you should do.
Yeah, right. Maybe I'm too much an educationalist for letting go the normativity altogether. Because, of course, I mean, I constantly ask my... I don't want to talk too much about my own questions, but yeah. they are there. I mean, people tend to want something from theory that offers a kind of handhold.
So, yeah, many people do. It's what they have been taught theory is. But maybe growing up is not needing that. And maybe if you think about inspiration rather than handholds, that things become more interesting, huh?
Yeah, of course, handholds can be also very inspiring, and the other way around, you can be inspired without handholds. Yeah. But I can see where you're going. Okay, Annemarie, we've taken up a lot of your time. So my last question is, what are you currently working on?
Yeah, I have moved on from eating to cleaning.
Oh.
And I'm working on the question, what is clean and how are various versions of clean done in practices? For instance, to give a small example, last year when the COVID epidemic or pandemic was starting to rage, we were very concerned, I'm working on this with others, about the way that hygienic clean is really celebrated everywhere, and everybody was using face masks, throwaway face masks, and all kind of nasty stuff to clean their hands. And so that the hygienic clean was celebrated, but pollution was generated. So the world has been made a lot more unclean in terms of the huge amounts of plastic and alcohol and other nasty stuff that has been thrown out into the world. And pollution is, of course, a long-term uncleanliness that is, how to say this, that suffers or that is generated to celebrate hygienic cleanliness. So we're working on all these variants of clean and how they're done in different places and how they're undone as well. And we do that also as a case of what it is to, because again, it's empirical philosophy. Again, just like with eating, I'm not just interested in eating, but this time it's not just interested in clean. It's also in the question, what is it to value? What is it to appreciate? What is it to say something good? And that aligns with this normativity question we were just talking about. Yeah. What are other ways of relating to goods and bads than the being normative and setting rules? So it's a theoretical question this time about valuing, and the empirical case is that of cleaning in all kind of, again, fairly mundane settings, in mundane to me, mundane in the surroundings where I live.
That sounds very interesting. And it's indeed, I can see many connections to questions we've talked about today. Thank you very much for joining me on the New Books Network.
Thank you.